Tonight, we're pleased to have with us Governor Madeleine Kunin of Vermont. Before we begin the event, however, I have a few announcements. The forum is still seeking speakers for its spring 1989 season. Upcoming events include Reginald Lewis, the Wall Street entrepreneur and CEO of the TLC and Beatrice Food Groups. That's on Thursday, March 9th. And Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, at a date to be announced in April. Both of these events will be held here in the Ames courtroom at 8 p.m. We anticipate an additional 2 to 4 programs this spring, so please keep your eyes peeled for forum posters and feel free to contact our office. The Forum 1L election meeting will be held this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. in Pound 101. We encourage all of our newest board members to come around and run for the forum board. Tonight, we're pleased to have with us Governor Madeleine Kunin, who is currently serving her third term as governor of Vermont. Governor Kunin is the first woman in U.S. history to be elected 3 times to a governorship. She's the first woman to be elected governor of Vermont and only the 3rd Democrat to hold that job. She first entered politics in 1972 when she was elected to the Vermont House of Representatives. There, she served as Democratic whip and chaired the House Appropriations Committee. She served as Lieutenant Governor of Vermont for 2 terms, and she has held teaching positions at Middlebury College and St. Michael's College in Vermont, as well as here at Harvard University at the Kennedy School of Government's Institute of Politics. During her tenure as governor, Kunin has championed the cause of educational reform, planning, state fiscal policy, environmental legislation, and child care. Last year, Governor Kunin won passage of a historic planning and growth law that will help the state and its communities retain their unique character. Funding for education has been increased 43% in the last 3 years, while the governor has also retired a record $35 million debt and led Vermont not only to its lowest unemployment rate in its history, but also the lowest rate in the country for the last consecutive 3 months. Governor Kunin also sits on the executive committee of the National Governors Association and was the co-chair of the Democratic National Convention's Platform Committee. The forum is pleased to welcome Governor Madeleine Kunin.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here this evening and share with you some observations about the shift of power from the federal government to state governments. I plan to discuss with you why the governors have taken on a greater leadership role in shaping domestic policy, both within our respective states and also how we've influenced domestic policy as a group, sometimes creating the necessary national consensus for change. I'd also like to point out that there are some limitations to this strategy, made more visible with the debut of a new administration. Now, I believe, is the time for the federal government to reassert and reaffirm its rightful domestic responsibilities in areas that overarch state boundaries. But before embarking on this subject, I would like to offer just some general comments on public life as a career choice for women as well as men, assuming that in addition to corporate law, there might be a number of likely candidates for public service for the offices, such as governor, members of Congress, and senators here at this event. Because I'm not yet typical of the governors of this country, I do have a natural missionary zeal to encourage more women to enter public life. Despite the spectacular inroads that women have made of late into the halls of power, including Harvard Law School and the field of medicine, the political sphere, as anyone knows who watches the evening news with any regularity, remains profoundly male-dominated. I recently wrote an op-ed piece about my reaction while watching President Bush's inauguration and described the class picture of the nation's power structure as it was posed on the Capitol steps on that day. And as my eyes scanned the crowd, the obvious hit me. Namely, that there were few women present and that the power structure of this country was still largely male. And grateful as I was to sit amongst the nation's governors, and as I am to sit there today, I cannot be satisfied with the status quo. As politics seems to get increasingly hostile and more expensive, it may be missionary work indeed to encourage either women or men to reduce their incomes, expose their personal lives, and step down into the hurly-burly world of politics. Nevertheless, I do. Fundamentally, I believe that the greatest reward for choosing public life is that one has the chance to directly experience the exhilarating feeling of having had an effect on the life of one's time. Whether that is illusion or reality is hard to determine. Only history will be the final arbiter, and the accuracy of those later assessments are often in dispute as well. But there are also periods of solid achievement, and I've experienced some of them in my 4 years as governor of Vermont. For example, getting a law passed to manage growth and development called Act 200, providing significant new child care initiatives to working families, increasing funding for public aid education. And there are personal satisfactions as well, such as living an exciting life and feeling a sense of connection to people and events. Why then, if those are the advantages, why then are there so few women in political life? There are many reasons, but I think the most obvious one is that our perception of leadership is largely shaped by precedent. Our leaders through the ages have predominantly been men. Therefore, it should not be surprising that leadership is equated with male traits. In addition, women more than men have traditionally chosen to influence events indirectly rather than directly, working in an ancillary role, one that I once had thought would be appropriate for me as well, working behind the scenes as a pleader for a cause or an advocate, educator of others, wife of a man who might do important things, mother of sons and daughters who would play out our ambitions. The direct role is more dangerous, to be sure, but the results are great. The political life, more than anything else I know, continues to permit one to set the agenda and to use the bully pulpit to determine what is important and to lay out a strategy to make those important things happen. On a personal level, it is a way to lead a meaningful life. Perhaps election campaigns have become more negative in recent years, precisely because the prize has become greater. As our lives depend increasingly on government decisions, competition for political power becomes fiercer yet, power more entrenched and concentrated. All the more reason to have good women and men engaged in the battle. As we construct the pyramid of power, the president, without doubt, is at the apex. Down at the base are mayors and local officials. Although the protocol of politics has traditionally placed governors ahead of senators, possibly because there are only 50 of us and 100 of them, most voters have tended to think otherwise, placing U.S. senators and congressmen higher on the scale, because obviously they work in Washington, where they seem to transcend state boundaries. In recent years, however, governors have captured more of the limelight. Certainly in the Reagan years, it appears that a power shift has occurred from Washington to the states. For example, those concerned about the question of abortion, on either side of that question, will focus their attention soon to the states, where this question will be decided on a state-by-state basis if Roe versus Wade is overturned or significantly modified. But the shift in power to the states began in a determined way at the dawn of the Reagan era. It is somewhat ironic that President Reagan intended this to be a conservative shift, believing that the federal government had become too intrusive, and that if Washington showed restraint, the states surely would display commensurate common sense and cease and desist from enlarging government's responsibilities. Self-reliance, the old pull them up by the bootstraps mentality, would suffice. Plus, the savings, of course, on the domestic side could then be transferred for defense purposes. But the former president's plan was only partially carried out. Yes, there were cuts and continue to be in domestic spending. I know that firsthand. The state of Vermont, for example, has calculated that this year we have $58 million less in federal funds than we would prior to the federal cuts. That's out of a total general fund budget of $586 million. In each year, we back and fill in such areas as Medicaid, services to the elderly, housing, always to compensate for these losses. That is precisely what Reagan did not anticipate, that the states would not passively accept the federal retreat. And we went further. We became activists and have become the innovators, often the experts, in forging domestic policy. Without the former president's cuts in domestic spending, which pushed new responsibilities our way, we, the nation's governors, probably would not have achieved our present prominence. Reagan created a vacuum, which we readily filled. He also created something else, and that is new grassroots constituencies for the problems which had been ignored for 8 years: the environment, housing, education, childcare. Thwarted in the nation's capital, they found an audience in state capitals. Problems did not disappear, they simply surfaced at a different level of government. These constituencies are now beginning to be recognized for the first time on the national level. It is too early to determine their strength, because the question that remains is what will be the federal response in real dollars. But they are being heard, if ever so faintly, by the new Bush administration, as evidenced by his inaugural and budget speeches. The change in policy, breaking the old logjams on the environment, the homeless, education, to name a few, should not, however, be viewed as a dramatic change in national policy. It is rather a question of now having found a national focal point for policies that had been percolating all along within the state capitals. Forgive me for repeating the metaphor of 1,000 points of light, but in fact, the states have been igniting them, and now they are ready to converge for the first time in Washington. Let us look at the issue of welfare reform as an example. The White House had traditionally denied that there was a welfare problem by blaming the victim rather than the system. The answer to reform was to starve the system to death and thereby separate the unworthy from the worthy. We all remember the truly needy. The nation's governors, however, expressing themselves as a group through the National Governors Association, knew from their experience that the welfare problem was more complicated than that. We in our separate jurisdictions had designed programs that got people off welfare and into the workplace, not by telling stories about welfare queens, but by breaking down the practical barriers to work and providing what was needed: childcare, job training, education. In Massachusetts, the program is called ET. In Vermont, we call it REACHUP, and both are working. Modest changes can sometimes make a major difference. For example, my conversation with a recently employed single parent revealed that a $50 clothing allowance made all the difference for her. Being able to dress properly for a job interview enabled her to have the courage and self-respect to get a job. Using our experience, the governors, conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, developed a unified proposal for the Congress, and the result is a welfare reform law, which was referred to as the governor's bill by its chief sponsor, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York. What is the lesson here? The states filled the vacuum left by federal cuts, and they went one step further. They helped develop a national consensus which provided the basis for congressional action. We laid the groundwork, overcoming the polarity which had persisted for many years between conservatives and liberals on this issue. Without the bipartisan prompting of the governors, I'm confident that welfare reform law would not have been enacted. You may also be certain that the law will be effectively implemented by the states, since it is partly our creation. Another example of the states filling the policy gap is the environment. As the federal government established a policy or a posture of not-so-benign neglect, the states had little choice but to spring into action. Our constituencies demanded it, and so did our consciences. Protecting the public by dealing with solid waste, water pollution, air pollution, toxic and hazardous waste has become a demanding and very expensive state responsibility. Not only has the federal government failed to provide sufficient funds to support costly and necessary clean water and clean air policies, it has failed to exercise interstate discipline. It's obvious today that we cannot continue a state-by-state environmental agenda as global air pollution heats up our planet. But what the states have accomplished in this slack period is nevertheless significant. By taking state action, we have taken the initiative in some areas like solid waste and clean water, and we have also proven that there is, in fact, a strong environmental constituency, growing larger and more impatient each day. Now that the Reagan era has passed and the Bush administration shows signs of environmental sensitivity, there is cause for some optimism that a national environmental agenda will take shape, one which goes far beyond the limitations set by the prior administration, which persisted in believing that the price of a clean environment was simply too high to pay. Again, the question is the extent of that commitment in the new administration. In addition to saying that one is in favor of eliminating the hazards of acid rain, one also has to set pollution tolerance levels and be willing to pay the price financially to make that a reality. But increasingly, a consensus is emerging, which in fact equates threats to our environment with threats to our very survival, similar to that of nuclear war. That parallel is no longer regarded as hyperbole. And global warming, of course, is the most urgent example. The nation's governors, while eager environmental advocates within the confines of our respective states, have found it is difficult. It is as difficult as the Congress to join forces on a national environmental agenda. We, too, have had our geographic polarizations. Particularly issues related to energy production, such as the causes and consequences of acid rain, have polarized the governors and created a stalemate. Today, there are signs that may be changing, both with the Bush administration and amongst the nation's governors. I chair the National Governors Association Committee on Energy and the Environment. And in that capacity, I can tell you that we are presently putting together the finishing touches on a national energy policy. It is not perfect and won't satisfy everyone. However, it's as close to consensus as any of us ever dreamt we could be. In that relative light, it is a near miracle. Interestingly, that policy in its draft form makes the following statement on global warming. Quote, there are environmental implications associated with energy policy choices. Mounting concerns over ozone pollution, acid deposition, and global warming bring this issue to the forefront. We must recognize and address the short and long-term environmental impacts of our energy choices and make them environmentally acceptable. The governors believe addressing these environmental concerns can be accomplished most effectively by improving the efficiency of this nation's energy use and by making sure that choices among fuels and energy products and services reflect their true environmental cost. End of quote. Until that statement, and it is not yet official, the country has been divided largely into energy-producing states and energy-consuming states with little agreement between the two. This is the first bridge. It is possible that if the nation's governors reach formal consensus on a national energy policy, including the effects of global warming, that this consensus may provide the boost that the Congress needs to act to set strict and meaningful national clean air standards. The new Bush administration conveyed a hopeful message recently from Secretary of State James Baker several days ago when he spoke before a 17-nation working group formed to develop policies to deal with global warming. He said, and I quote, "The political ecology is now ripe for action," an interesting phrase. While scientists still must refine the state of our knowledge about the causes and effects of the threat, Mr. Baker said, we can probably not afford to wait until all of the uncertainties have been resolved before we do act. Time will not make the problem go away. End of quote. Certainly a clear contrast to the Reagan litany of study and delay. Now, governors have become environmental leaders for two very practical reasons. One, to fill the vacuum left by Washington, and two, because we see firsthand the devastating effects of global pollution. Our constituents demand action because they, in fact, are paying a high economic price for neglect. And the garbage and trash that washed up on the beaches of the Eastern Seaboard are one indicator of that. As governor of the state of Vermont, I fully understand that national and international action is necessary to solve some of the environmental crises that plague me at home. I become an actor on that stage of necessity. Let me give you a modest example. 2 years ago, we discovered a new pest. It is called a pear thrips, and it has, contrary to its name, vastly expanded its finicky taste from pear trees to maple trees and more. This past summer, it infested some 500,000 acres of Vermont forest land. I appointed a committee of experts to develop a solution for the pear thrips invasion, which threatens to destroy something very special about Vermont. Can you imagine Vermont without maple syrup and fall foliage? The committee surmises our maple trees are susceptible to these bugs because they have been weakened by air pollution. No spray as yet can dull their appetite. I have little choice except to push for global action to save the maple industry in Vermont. Increasingly, governors are players in the international arena, not only on behalf of the environment, but also to foster trade and international understanding. Once the least likely of ambassadors, today there's not a governor in the land who has not led a foreign trade mission. The governors of three states, in fact, Vermont, Alaska, and Iowa, have gone one step further to establish a sister state within the Soviet Union. It was our early awareness of international competition, which closed factories within our areas and siphoned off jobs to the Pacific Basin, which first made governors international travelers. We became fast learners because product learning that when people were laid off, it was because productivity was higher and cost cheaper in Japan and Korea and sometimes Germany. And it was this competition, this discovery, which plunged us into another area, and that is public education. We were one of the first to directly realize that our children weren't learning as well as their foreign competitors, and that is why governors immersed themselves in education reform, an area that had not traditionally been a state responsibility. Now, in his budget address, it was gratifying to note that the president paid attention to the education issue. Although, again, the dollars to be allocated there are not comparable to the task. It will take more than rhetoric to make Bush the education president he would like to be. Nevertheless, the mere fact that he recognizes the national importance of education offers some comfort. In the last 8 years, we have seen a decided shift of power to the states. And rather than doing what President Reagan intended, which was to subdue government's appetite for domestic spending and reform, the result has been quite the opposite. The states have been a spawning ground for activism. And the shift has enabled the states to develop innovative and often effective policies, which we are now anxious to share, at least financially, with the federal government. We don't want to go back to the old days when we were more or less instruments of federal authority, and when the theory was that the states had to be prodded by either the carrot or the stick to address urgent domestic needs. That was prior to President Johnson's war on poverty, prior to the civil rights movement. Both those efforts were really efforts to move the states forward into areas of progressive reform. We were the laggards. In the Reagan years, we have often been in the vanguard. We have developed that articular constituency for the programs that I have described. And most recently, another example, when Congress wanted some expert testimony 2 weeks ago on a proposed child care law, it was interesting that Governor Schaefer of Maryland and I were asked to testify because we have done some of the child care innovations within our states. But despite our success, the bill that would support and strengthen state initiatives and provide uniform child care standards is not, to my knowledge, in the Bush budget. So gentle words will not suffice. Hard commitment is required. With the new Bush administration, I believe that these constituencies, which have been developing all along, will assert a new and more powerful national voice. And with that come rising expectations, which the president will be expected to fulfill. Other problems, however, larger than the capacity of any single state to address, which have been buried or squelched because of lack of national acknowledgement, will now also come to the surface. Chief amongst these are the problems of affordable housing and access to health care. These are two examples of some of the problem areas which the states, in all honesty, have not succeeded in addressing with any satisfactory results. Massachusetts and the state of Washington each have pioneered new pilot approaches to provide health care for the uninsured. But the results, which will be closely watched, are fraught with some financial risk. We in Vermont are beginning to address these same questions, knowing that the need for health insurance and health care cost control are great, but not having the capacity to tackle these issues single-handedly, totally, without any federal support. Housing is a similar problem. The persistent and shameful evidence of the homeless is witness to our shared failure. We all merit some blame, but I have concluded that satisfactory solutions to these domestic problems are beyond the capacity of states, certainly of small and moderate income states like Vermont. Yet we must also continue to push forward on our own while we prod Washington to act. I believe now is the time to inaugurate a new era of state-federal partnership. It is imperative that the federal government reassert its traditional role, which is still to help create equal opportunity for all Americans, regardless of whether they live in Vermont, Massachusetts, or Mississippi. That will require making tough financial choices, as well as a sustained commitment to change at the highest levels. One reason for the governor's success has been that we have been able to achieve consensus and that we've had a hands-on approach to government. As CEOs, we've had to be pragmatists. We are responsible for problems and we have to find solutions to make things work. When people's water supplies are polluted, when there's no more fish in the stream, we hear about it and somebody wants an answer and somebody wants a solution. When mothers cannot obtain childcare, when employees cannot find a good education, you may be sure that we're the first to know. And that is how we have become environmentalists, welfare reformers, and education governors. Now it is time to integrate our agenda with the national agenda. We don't want to abrogate the new responsibility that we have acquired. We've enjoyed it, it's been creative, we want to continue it, and we want the flexibility to sustain it. But we do need a partnership with the federal government, both to strengthen that agenda and to address some of the issues that are beyond the purview of our individual states to manage. Only a true shift in priorities within the new Bush administration, one that focuses on the environment and on domestic needs such as education, housing, health care, and welfare reform, will enable us to meet the needs and fulfill the hopes of the American people. Thank you.
If there are questions, you can use the microphones on either side.
In your program as on energy policy, are you looking strongly at natural gas as becoming a very important resource?
Yes, it certainly is a more benign resource in terms of its effect on global warming and production of carbon dioxide. It's a question of having access to natural gas, and Vermont is in the process of being in the early stages of having a natural gas pipeline go through it. I think we can't suddenly, though, on a national level, make a sudden transition from the existing sources of energy to others. I think it'll be a major economic dislocation on a national scale, and a lot of thought and a lot of planning and a lot of care has to go into how we do that. Because, for example, in the coal area, when it comes to global warming, my understanding is that there is no such thing as clean coal. Coal in and of itself produces CO2, which has an effect on global warming. So while we may be able to make some changes in our state, I see it as a major national problem to really figure out what sources of energy are least polluting, least harmful, how we really seriously address conservation, which I think will have to again be a very important strategy for different reasons than it was 10 and 15 years ago.
Governor, you made frequent references in your address to a new federal and state partnership. However, you also acknowledged repeatedly that the creativity that the federal government's abstention has caused in the states has been positive for the nation as a whole and for the states in particular. When you talk about a new federal-state relation, are you talking about federal guidelines and a federalization of some of these areas, or is what you're really asking for more money, and that's it?
Well, I'm asking, let me be more specific about that. As I indicated, I think it's been a creative period for the states, and we have, out of necessity and sometimes out of initiative, develop programs to address certain problems which were not being addressed at the federal level. But there are limits to that strategy. That is what we are finding. There are also still great financial differences in the capacity of states to finance those programs. If you take an area like healthcare, the taxing capacity of a state like Vermont is different from Massachusetts, is different from Texas. The classic role of the federal government has been the great equalizer, that when there are certain necessities, that the federal government gives grants based on the ability of states to pay and tries to equalize those financial differences. That's where I think the federal government has to continue to play a role in providing that financial assistance in order to equalize the opportunity of states to carry out their programs. We don't want more federal guidelines, except in some selective areas. For example, the child care law that is being debated now and actually has bipartisan and conservative and liberal sponsorship. The co-sponsors include Senator Orrin Hatch as well as Senator Chris Dodd. So you've got an interesting combination there. And they both agree that some kind of federal guidelines, standards for child care is appropriate. We don't want it to be overbearing. And I realize we're being a little fussy here. We would like some federal support for equity. We would like federal direction for issues that overarch state jurisdictions, such as acid rain. We can't stop the air at our borders. It comes from Ohio. We can't ship it back. It has a devastating effect. We can't change it unless national policy changes, which affects what Ohio emits into the atmosphere. So I guess the simple answer is we'd like to keep our own flexibility. We'd like more money in some instances where there are different state capabilities to pay. And we'd like some national standards in areas that truly are of national significance.
Thank you very much, Governor.
Governor, I'd like to ask you about something that you didn't address during your speech, namely the future of the Democratic Party. The party has now lost the last three presidential elections, and the reaction of the Democratic establishment has been to blame it all on Michael Dukakis. I guess just proving the truth of the old political maxim, always kick a man when he's down. And then at the same time, if they blame it on Dukakis, the party asserts that there's nothing wrong with us and the people haven't deserted us. Do you believe this assessment? If so, why? And if not, what does the Democratic Party have to do to start winning at a national level?
Very good question. I'm glad you asked it. I wish I had a real quick answer, because I think we're all really, you know, looking at the tea leaves and trying to figure out what the future is and what went wrong. I agree with you. It doesn't do a whole lot of good to simply spend hours blaming the past and blaming the candidate. That doesn't put us ahead. I see some hope in, real hope, in the new Democratic chairman, Ron Brown. I think he seems to have the ability to bring us together. And if there's anything that the Democratic Party needs at this point, is to get over some of the factionalism that has divided us. I think he'll really be severely tested in the next several years if he can develop a united Democratic Party. And then in addition, we really have to figure out more effectively, more articulately, what we stand for. I think we've gone a long way in campaigns criticizing what we are against. I don't think we have successfully expressed a vision for the future. We've gone back to history, you know, to FDR, to Kennedy, to our heroes, and we've criticized the immediate present, but we haven't really quite given people enough of a positive reason in fairly good times to change administrations. One of the ironies is that the governors have done very well, and that the Congress has done well. And the big question mark is, why can't we win the presidency if that is the case? You know, if people are willing to vote Democratic at these levels, why can't they transfer that Democratic allegiance to the highest office in the land? And I think the answers are fairly elusive on that score, but we should be able to do better than we have, especially with that foundation of Democratic talent and Democratic support. I think one reason that we haven't captured the presidency is that times people still vote a lot on economic issues and fear change. And I think the next Democratic presidential candidate has to prove he or she has economic strength, can handle a secure nation, also has a personality that communicates a sense of security to the people.
Thank you.
Governor, let me return to the drier but still interesting topic of federalism. And in your answer to the previous question, you stressed the disparity in the abilities of states to pay for significant services. I'm wondering if there are substantial programs that you think are more properly a function of state government. Particularly, I'm thinking about public transportation, public works programs. And I'm wondering if there is some reallocation along the Reagan vision that you think would be appropriate. This isn't an advocate's question, just an informational one. But if you think that there is some realignment that's in order, or if you think that the basic status quo is right.
I guess I am speaking, you know, as a governor who would like to have as much flexibility as possible. I think probably the best federal programs are block grants that allow us to figure out the fine print. And that probably isn't the way the world's going to continue to work. But actually, that's been one of the positive innovations as far as they've gone of the Reagan years, is more flexibility in that regard. The negative side has been that they keep shrinking in dollar amounts, and that we've had to cope with that whittling down. There have been proposals in the past, you know, that the federal government take over all of the welfare system, for example. I'm not sure I buy into that. I think the base system as it exists should be there and still give the states the flexibility to hold on. I think health care is one area where we should have a national system, and that there should be total insurance coverage for the uninsured. I think that is necessary for a number of reasons. One is the question of cost control has to be integrated with the question of expanding health care. And nobody's been able to fully answer that question. And we also have to equate cost control with quality. So right now, whenever you mention cost control, people envision reduced quality. Cost control can actually mean enhanced quality if it is done appropriately. But you can't have, you know, 50 state policies in that regard. The states, I think, are in the process of coming up with some good ideas. But I think for the long term, we have to have a stronger national health policy and health insurance.
Yeah. Governor, I've got two closely related questions about education. The first is, in the course of your talk, you made a statement that I didn't quite understand about the fact that states are becoming more and more in control of education. I found that kind of puzzling, since I think, as far as I know, through my experience, that states have always been that education has always been within the province of the states. And the second question is that education to me seems like one area where people are increasingly demanding a greater national, federal role in education, partly because of a kind of reverse phenomenon from what you've said, described tonight, in the sense that many states, not including yours, I don't think, but many other states have abdicated their responsibilities with respect to education, and which has created a vacuum which the federal government has sought to fill. And I was wondering, first of all, if you could clarify what your statement meant when you mentioned it, and second of all, what you see as the federal role in education and the relationship between the federal government and the states.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'd be glad to clarify that. The states have not had the same kind of role in education. When I said the states had not been there, to the extent that they are now, I was really deferring to local government. It was local government, and it still is largely, which has direct control through local school boards and local taxes over education. And in a state like Vermont, that is fiercely guarded, and I suspect that is true elsewhere as well. What the governors have done is become really the advocates and have increasingly taken more responsibility for financing education as well as emphasizing quality. Again, go back to the National Governors Association, which when Lamar Alexander from Tennessee was chairman of the Governors Association, education was the issue of the year, and the governors issued a report on excellence. And that still is kind of the benchmark for education reform. And what governors found, which is the obvious truth, is that they could not really raise the standard of living of their states without getting very much engrossed in education. And it was actually the southern states that took the lead on that. And probably the first governor to do that was Governor Winters of Mississippi. And most recently, in this New York Times on Sunday, there were three southern governors featured, and the article discussed how they are trying to be reformers in their states. And it was, again, Mississippi and Arkansas and Louisiana. And education is where they put their major investment. And the point I tried to make was that there is a direct recognition of the relationship of education and economic growth. And that's why governors have become advocates of education, have put a larger and larger share of their budgets into education. The federal government has set certain requirements in education. And the most visible requirement there is something called Public Law 94-192, the law on the handicapped. And originally, the federal government was going to play an increasingly significant role in financing that, and was going to pay 40% of the share of special education costs. Well, the requirements are there, but the federal government has never paid its share of those costs. And I think, at least in the state of Vermont, the federal financial share is about 4 or 5%. And I would gather that it's not much larger throughout the country. So the federal government has set certain standards, which had to be set. I don't argue with those, but they never follow through with the support. Where they have played a very positive role is programs like Title III for lower-income children, and those kinds of programs have been very helpful, probably need to be somewhat expanded. I don't think we want a real heavy participation by the federal government. That's always the dilemma. You know, if you send money, you usually send regulations. The check doesn't come unencumbered. And that is one of the dilemmas that the states face. And that's why I go back to the block grants. We'd obviously love the flexibility. We need the financial assistance, but we realize the federal government needs some accountability. So it's a constant kind of tug of war between us. But I think we are entering a different stage at this point, where there is real encouragement given to these constituencies, like environmentalists, like people who care about housing and health care, by both Bush's inaugural address and his budget address. He has put it into the debate in a way that it was excluded before. I think that means that there are high expectations that there will be a financial commitment. I think if there isn't a financial commitment, if it is only rhetoric, there will be genuine disappointment and anger. And I think that is kind of the dilemma that they are facing at the present time.
Hi, Governor.
Hi.
I don't ask this question with bitter skepticism, but because I grew up in Chicago, where Mayor Daley was an automatic and where people were elected from their jail cells, can you get to be in power and do the things you were talking about right in the beginning of your speech and still be true to yourself? In other words, if Mike Dukakis' style isn't to pull the same dirty tricks and then we all see him lose because of it, is there any hope for those of us who want to help the world and make an impact but don't want to become crooks and cheats and go against our own style? I ask it because I trust you. You look trustworthy. So.
Come to Vermont. That's a very fundamental question, and I'm glad that you asked it. And, you know, there are days all of us in public life ask ourselves that question from time to time. We can't act as if the world is like the League of Women Voters or Civics 101. It isn't, but neither is it quite like Chicago or the stories or some of the scandals that we hear about all over the country on a pretty regular basis. I think you can be true to yourself. I think you have to be true to yourself. That doesn't mean you don't compromise and you develop consensus, but you don't compromise in terms of integrity. You can compromise on the issues. There's room in politics for lots and lots of people and lots of different styles and lots of different backgrounds and ways of doing things. It's a much more welcoming system than you might think, at least in certain areas. I think what you need most of all is a passionate feeling that you want to change something. And then you need some discipline to figure out how you're going to get there and to stick with it. And I guess you need some faith in yourself and some confidence in yourself to do that. But you do not have to sell your soul. And I think what the most discouraging thing is that because we are in a fairly bitter, hostile time, judging by the last campaign, that people like you might opt out. And the more people who do pretty much write the system off, the more concentrated the power becomes. So that those who do think they have the qualifications as they see them described on the television evening news, they will concentrate their power and continue the status quo even more strongly. And that would be a great tragedy. Someone recently wrote that probably the most dangerous political statement to say to make is I'm just not interested in politics. There is no protection in disinterest.
Governor, yes. You alluded to the fact that different areas have very different problems and even conflicting interests sometimes. In Vermont, Burlington is the only urban area in a very rural state, is an extreme example of this. Yet the problems in Burlington go way beyond the city limits. How do you view the relation between the state government and local governments? Is it similar to the way you view the federal and state government relations? In particular, are you advocating state block grants to cities?
Well, there's some suspicion between state government and local government. And it, needless to say, often surprises me as governor, but it's there. It's, I must tell you, when I first got elected to the legislature in 1974, I thought first that I would have a hard time as a woman, second as a Democrat, and two of those played a role, but what really was the biggest obstacle for me was I was the member from Burlington, which was the big city in relationship to the rest of the state. So there is kind of an urban-rural tension that you speak of. In fact, the joke that some people make about Burlington is what's so wonderful about Burlington is so close to Vermont. But the block grant system does work in some ways. We may not call it block grants, but we do, in fact, give a lot of aid to communities. In fact, if you looked at our state budget, you would see about a third of it goes back to the towns in forms of state aid to education and other programs. Even in our social services, we don't administer carry out our social programs strictly with state employees in Montpelier. We contract a lot with local community services for things like child care, counseling, mental health. So in effect, it is a shared responsibility. Perhaps not always to everybody's total satisfaction, but we do try to give as much local input, local authority as we feel is practical.
I am sorry to do this because I'm sure you're trying to get out of here at some point.
Oh, no, I welcome the questions.
You know, I always feel like everybody has to ask a question. But I am curious about your thoughts on, how can I phrase this, the intersection between governance and politics, to be cute about it. By politics, I mean bipartisanship. Wondering is the success you've had as a governor, whether with each sort of passing election, yes, there is some relevance in party affiliation, but I think about the example you gave of the bill co-sponsored by Orrin Hatch and Chris Dodd as making a comment about how one sort of integrates good government on the one hand, whatever that means, and the role of the party, and then put that against the backdrop of what you've been talking about this evening in terms of the shift between the shifting relationship between the states and the federal government, predominantly Republican versus predominantly Democratic, and how this really plays out your own experience or how you see it in general.
Well, I don't mentally make a distinction between government and politics. So I think I can see how you would see it as, you know, separate worlds where one probably seems more pure than the other, or at least less polarized in a sense. Is that what you mean? I think you have to be good at both. You cannot have a disdainful attitude about politics as such. Because political parties and political organizations, in their best sense, are organizational tools. And one of the things that you learn very quickly is that you can't get much done without the votes. And to get the votes, you have to develop consensus, and you have to develop coalitions. And party structures are still the best vehicle for coalition building. And therefore, they're very, very important tools to getting something done politically. Sometimes it seems expedient, you know, as if people just vote because of a party label. That's probably less and less so. Certainly it's less true in states like Vermont. It may be more true in other states. But in the best of all possible worlds, they are integrated. Doesn't always happen. Sometimes one seems totally detached from the other, and a party decision may seem like a crass political decision and a government decision, maybe, you know, simply a good government decision. But in a democracy, you hope that they converge. I realize that's idealistic. I should probably give you some examples of seeing that at work. The law that I talked about, Act 200, our planning law, it started out bipartisan, that people were for planning. We held some hearings around Vermont, formed a commission on Vermont's future to kind of learn what people wanted for the future of our state. Found out that they were very concerned about the loss of farmland, the loss of quality of life, the loss of community. And there was broad bipartisan consensus on that. Then we developed a bill to try to provide a structure to plan so that we would have some control over our future. The more the bill developed, the more the Republicans dropped off and the Democrats coalesced. In the end, it was pretty much a partisan battle. And it was, if I had not had the support of the party in that sense, would not have gotten the law passed. So in the heat of battle, when it was, you know, polarized into the role of government versus no role for government or a more modest role for government in order to plan, partisanship erupted. And it was a fight. And it was a fight that one had to work very hard to win. Now that the law is law, that partisanship is again beginning to drift away. And as it is being better understood and beginning to be utilized, it goes back to how do we make it work, and it becomes a government issue again. But if I had dropped the ball when it became a party issue, I wouldn't have the law in place today. So you have to be prepared to do both. Thank you. Oh, you have a question.
Yeah. One last question. Governor, you mentioned your dissatisfaction at the status quo in terms of the number of women who are involved in the political arena. What do you think it will take to change this? And do you have any concrete examples or encouragements for women? Or do you have any type of program that you think will change the situation?
Well, I recently learned, or the statement was made, I think it was by the Women's Political Caucus in Washington or the Women's Campaign Fund, that at the present rate of change, giving 99% of congressmen get reelected who run, at the current level of turnover, it would take 410 years for women to have 50% of the representation in the United States Congress. That's a fairly depressing statistic. I decided then that the major barrier to equal representation for women is not gender bias. It plays a role, but not as significant a role as one might think. The major barrier is incumbency. And my recommendation is, I wrote this article on it, and I'm going to be talking about it tomorrow morning on a television program, is that we limit the number of terms of congressmen and senators. Now, that's a fairly controversial suggestion, fairly difficult to achieve, but the only way you're going to get new people into the system and stop the system from being permanently entrenched with the present structure is to have a required rate of turnover. Now, governors have that, not all. In my own state of Vermont, we don't. But we have two-year terms, however, which keeps you in good condition. Certainly gives you lots of public scrutiny. But 21 states do have a limit on their terms. And actually, I think it would be easier in the long term for women to be elected governor than it would to be elected to the Congress at the present rate of change. The other advice I would give is simply to encourage more women to run. I think, as I said, the gender bias is there, but it is not overwhelming. It can be overcome. And actually, when women run for office, they do pretty well. They do about, on average, as well as men, if you take everything into consideration. A lot of them run for tough seats and thereby get defeated. But when they run for open seats and are experienced candidates, they do quite well. So join the fray. That would be the best advice.
Please, Governor, if I may ask, perhaps by introduction, another reference to Chicago, one of the perhaps best mayors we've had, Jane Byrne, of course, a woman. And a particular thing occurs to me there, the incidents that the public housing incidents of crime were materially reduced when she moved into the public housing, which is a sort of commitment, of course, that one rarely sees. But what is being done to increase local input? It occurs to me that the technological innovations that we've seen would presumably at some point provide for a suggestion system that would essentially mean that a governor might address almost every query. Are you aware of anything of this nature, and what would you say on this issue?
I guess I'm trying to zero in on one part of your question. Perhaps you could rephrase it for me?
The issue is local input. The issue is perhaps the what New England idealizes,
like the town meeting.
And the concept, of course, technologically could theoretically be extended to soliciting suggestions from every single voter and almost in some sense using a system to, as it were, concentrate the particular issues and see what really concerns.
I guess technologically there are television programs where you could have audiences.
Cube system in Cincinnati, for example, that's several years.
Well, certainly, you know, you welcome public input and you welcome public suggestions. And in a state like Vermont, you have ample opportunity to do that because you really do get out and about and meet a lot of people. But I think in the future, I have heard where it is possible to have this kind of interactive television where people could have kind of direct communication and suggestions and even vote in their living rooms. I think that has been tried, where they express their opinion immediately, whether they like something or don't like something. I'm not sure I'm ready for that, but it certainly would be an interesting idea for the public. But I think as a governor, you cannot always simply reflect public opinion. You do have to sometimes make decisions which may not be immediately popular. I mean, one of the things governors unfortunately have to do is say no to certain budgetary requests, for example. And if you want to keep a balanced budget, you have to be fairly tough-minded and try to figure out priorities. A legislative person can, of course, much more readily respond to a particular constituency and say that they will be aligned with that and push for that and make it happen. But we have to watch the overall bottom line. So the role of governor sometimes is reflective of public opinion, sometimes is reflective of basic management decisions, which may or may not be popular. Did you have a question?
Governor, you're to be commended for the fact that you've set your state on a course of fiscal responsibility. And I wondered if you could address that to us with some specifics.
Well, that is one of the hardest things. You know, we find ourselves in Vermont right now. We do not have a deficit. We are surrounded by states who do have deficits, and we are working very hard to avoid having a deficit down the road a piece. The natural tendency of government is to expand. The natural sign of success is to offer more programs. And there are needs out there. So there are both political pressures and genuine needs that promote states just as well as the federal government to expand. And somehow you have to keep that within the ability to pay and the taxpayer to support that system. It means making some tough choices at the state level. And we've been fortunate that we've had a very strong economy in Vermont. We've had the, as you noted in the introduction, one of the lowest unemployment rates. And Vermont used to be a very poor state. We used to be considered kind of the backwoods area of New England. So our transformation is quite remarkable. And I hope that it can be sustained. The downside of our economic growth, though, is that we're also losing some things that people are not happy about either. We're losing some of our farmland, some of our open spaces, some of our sense of community. Our real challenge, which I think is a challenge for all of New England, is, you know, how do we stay kind of true to ourselves? How do we keep the best of what is Vermont without kind of turning into a Courier or an Ives print, which we cannot afford to be. Well, I thank you very, very much.